You know, as Jeffrey was speaking, I was looking at my slides going, well, there's that one. There's that one. However, I have to admit, I had no slides in the Yellow Submarine. So, and it might seem I appreciated Rob's comments about how well things are going. And one of the things that I worry about, because, you know, as an academic, my job is to worry. My job is to show up and, you know, not fondle undergraduates. But anyway, which I do well. I worry about what happens when economic times get good. Because I think that what's great is that we have data that says that as economic times get tough, library usage goes up. And I think that's really important for a couple of things. I mean, not like, yay, depression. But I think it's really important because it demonstrates the vitality and the necessity of these services that we offer. I think, actually, it's a really interesting piece of evidence. However, I worry about people losing that attention. And I worry about what's going to keep them coming back again and again and over time. That led to this sort of interesting trip around the world to think about what is the sort of future of libraries and what should it be. And I want to be really clear that when I ask about the question about what is the future of libraries, I don't think that's a good question. Because what is the future of libraries makes it sound like it's going to happen to us. That it's somehow dictated and we're going to walk into it or it's going to walk into us. I really like the question about what should be the future of libraries. Because I think that really is about action. And it's about activity. And it's about the idea that we shape that future. We don't shape every aspect of it. We certainly can't shape everything that's going to happen to us. But it really does put us in the driver's seat of talking about how things are changing. Now, one of the things that drives my wife insane is that I'm slightly obsessive, and I learned a really bad thing in high school, which was in high school our English class would play songs and you'd have to listen to the lyrics. And one of the assignments was you had to come in with the song lyrics and you had to break it down and analyze what they were saying. And somehow, you know, the Jesuit education, when they were slamming me into lockers, stuck the switch so that every time you hear a song, I have to listen to the lyrics. And so my wife would say, this is a great song. I said, you know, do you realize it's about this? It's like, no, don't tell me. And so the other night, and I forget what television show it was on, it wasn't Bob Dylan, but it was a version of The Times Are Changing. And so I liked it, and so, you know, it's like now I've got to listen to that song over and over again, and then I get, like, every version of that song, and, you know, you realize there's a Byrds version of that song, and, you know, there's a James Taylor version of that song, and such. So you listen to these lyrics, and it's like, wait a minute, this is really important stuff. You know, and I don't know if it's because, I don't know, election of a new charismatic president who has an historical first in an area of anti-war sentiment. Growing and area of massive change and cultural change. I have no idea if there's an analogy to what was going on when Bob Dylan was writing this song, but it's true. The times, they are changing, that we're really at a point of historic rethinking and rechanging and recasting. And I think that when you're in such an environment, you need some guidance. You need to figure out what's going to take you to tomorrow and the day after. And increasingly, those things that we used to look at as history to tell us that isn't happening anymore. I mean, even your own numbers, the idea that the delivery service, we're just having brief conversations, going through the roof, you know, is a result of we gave the patrons the ability to select these things. Wait a minute, are we insane? You know? And what happened? They did! Oh, my God! So I want to take this time to really sort of challenge and think about what's next. And so what I'm going to start with is a piece of common logic of librarianship, right? And the story about where librarianship comes from and what we do, right? So here's one. That's the idea that more books require inventory. That what happens is we begin collecting materials and we put them on our shelves and we put them in, and eventually they sort of get beyond our ability to remember where they are. I use the analogy of these old used bookstores where you walk in and they're just, you know, these books, you know, turning the sludge in front of you and decaying off of the shelves. And you walk into the proprietor and you say, I'm looking for the red book. And, you know, he goes, oh, yes. And, you know, like walks three aisles down and up 12 flights of stairs and pulls out the perfect book and hands it to you, right? It's when we get beyond the ability to do that. We get too much stuff, and so we have to come up with a way of inventorying it all so we know where it is. And it shifts our role as librarians from knowing the collection to being able to find stuff in the collection. We move from sort of the catalog to navigating the catalog. Well, as that inventory gets larger, we begin to have to break it down into classifications. We begin to have to take that thing and say, yeah, we can't just numerically order these things. We should put them in some sort of order, you know, history over here, mathematics over here, and such. And that this process, this classification or information organization process, really requires a professional level of effort. That we know that people aren't born speaking Boolean. People don't, you know, sort of come out of the womb and enter into first grade and then say, ah, Dewey, I understand now. We are not natural. The idea, we are abominations of nature that we think about these things. And that as these classification systems and these inventories get even larger, we need to automate them. We can't even, the paper, the cards, it doesn't keep up. Technology comes in, we automate them. And that automation then leads to our ability to network them together and create catalogs. And then once we network, we require standards. And so suddenly we worry about MARC. And suddenly we worry about, you know, if you remember back to Z3950 or my time at the Canadian National Library, the Z3950. Right? So this is sort of the common logic. Before I go too far into this, I want to make a cautionary note about the importance of initial assumptions. All right, or the law of unintended consequences. And that is, if you screw up your initial assumptions when you make these kinds of arguments, you end up in very weird places. So let me give you an example of a couple of weird places. And if you ever want to know more about it, Freakonomics is an excellent book on this topic. And they tell the story of a daycare center. I think it was in Israel. But a daycare center, and they had sort of the standard problem that daycare centers have, which is parents don't always quite make it there by closing time. So they closed at 5, and parents would show up at 5 minutes after 5, and 5:15, 5:30, and they were trying to figure out, this was a pain. We had to pay staff, we had to keep the lights on, people had to, it screwed everything up. And so, you know, the great phrase, we're the government, we're here to help you. So a couple of economists showed up to help them. And the economist said, oh, the problem is you haven't created a disincentive. There's really no cost involved on these people. So for them, other than a social cost, which clearly they don't care about, it doesn't hurt them. So what we do, because we live in a free market economy, and by the way, the one good thing about the idea of Wall Street tanking is, can we not ever hear about how we need to run more like efficiently like a business? One more time, I hear that crack. Anyway, so the economist said, so what we need to do is charge them. What they instituted was a charge, a fee, that if you show up and you pick up your children late, you're by God going to pay us $10, $20. And what they found after they implemented the charge, like the very next week, is the amount of people showing up late quadrupled. And in fact, up went even higher. Because what happened was, now being late was no longer being rude. Being late was something you could buy. It became a commodity, right? And it wasn't so painful. It wasn't like $3,000 for 30 minutes. It was something like, 10 minutes and you watch my kids? So I'm going to stop and get pizza on the way. Right? And you wouldn't abandon your children for $10. So the assumption that people will not do it because you have to pay was the wrong assumption. Right? It may have been the right assumption if they set it high enough, but the initial assumption was wrong, led to a really weird result. I want to give you another one. This is sort of a classic mathematics one, and that's the weather. And I'm sure all of your weather people up here in Massachusetts are perfect at predicting the weather. But if they are the only ones in the entire universe who are good at it. And in fact, what these little charts show you, because there's nothing better than showing charts, because that means I'm a scientist. This is degrees missed over time. And what it means is they ask these meteorologists, a couple like Channel 4 and Channel 5 in this location, to predict how hot it was getting, what's the high temperature. And this is, over time, how many degrees off. So they all start pretty clustered around 2 degrees off, and they end up by the end of the week up to 6 and 7 degrees off. Right? And this is precipitation. They ask them, if you predict weather, what's your percentage? You know, is it going to rain tomorrow? And once again, the idea that the farther you go out, the worse their prediction becomes. Now, this this phenomenon was originally discovered because when computers first became big and Noah took them, they said, we can now predict the weather because we can do all the calculations that were too hard to do by hand. So they threw in a bunch of data and they began tracking their accuracy. And what they noticed is they were really good at 1 day and 2 days and then suddenly became totally divergent. This became such an important divergence. This little thing that we take as a nuisance about not listening to them the past 2 days became such an interesting phenomenon. They created an entire area of mathematics for it called chaos theory and fractal geometry to try and predict how unpredictable they do. Right? So what I want, but my point,
you're wondering,
is once again, initial assumptions can lead to very different places. So let's look at our functional, common sense look at libraries. More inventory, larger inventory classification, people, bigger automation, networking standards. There is an assumption in here, an initial assumption that I am going to argue is a false assumption. And the false assumption is that everything in here is about these things. That, in fact, the entire way and process of what we do is based on the idea that this is the center of what we do. That, oh, well, more books requires, well, why do we need more books? Well, we're a library, we need more books. Why? Our collections have to get larger. Why? Right? This initial assumption that libraries are in the book business, that libraries are in the thing business, that libraries are in the artifact business, is what I take a lot of umbrage with. That's usually. It even influences, if you say, well, Dave, we don't think that way. Let me talk a little bit about how this even influences our history. See if this history sounds about right. Libraries, as we know them, really can trace their origin back to the Library of Alexandria, which was the enormous collection of materials from the known civilization, and it was tragically destroyed in a fire, and there are various stories about why that happened. And during the Middle Ages, we created these scriptoriums where monks kept knowledge alive by copying texts over and over again. And these texts eventually led to the printing press, which made knowledge replicable, and we could share it widely. Right? To the point where, as in the early colonies, people like Benjamin Franklin had such large collections that they actually ran out of room for them, and so in Philadelphia, he and a bunch of other learned gentlemen combined their materials together, and this formed the blueprint for the modern public library, which is as a common good. Right? Once again, the assumption in here is everything I just talked about was that knowledge is in the things, and that getting more things means getting more knowledge. Let me give you an alternative view of this. The Library of Alexandria, I'm going to start there too, but it should be interesting to know that the Library of Alexandria wasn't a place. It was a campus, and in fact had multiple buildings. And all that collection was actually not stored in the library. It was stored in a temple dedicated to the muses called the Musae. And so what would happen is that ships, and this is my favorite policy, if you could implement this within Massachusetts, I'd recommend it. Ships would come into port, and all the Alexandrian guards would show up and take every scroll they had on board and confiscate them, take them back to the campus where they would be copied, and they'd get the copies back to the boat. All right? So just all the iPods coming into Massachusetts, dumped here. Well, it's interesting about the Library of Alexandria is the materials, the stuff, the things, the collection wasn't the library. The library was a colonnade. It was an open campus where what they did was invite scholars and funded through patronage scholars from around the world to come and think. And they built it in such a way that the scholars had to walk by each other on a daily basis and talk and interact. And as they came up with new ideas and new learning, because this was, Alexandria saw this as vital to its economy, was the economy of ideas, they might write them down. But the minute they wrote them down, they would leave the library and go into the museum, into the museum. Right? Now, we push forward, and instead of thinking about this line, this history moving from Alexandria over to basically the Dark Ages in medieval Europe, where the monks were busy copying down religious artifacts, what was happening was actually in Islamic Spain, in the Moors of Spain, they had thousands of libraries. They had in these libraries thousands and thousands of scrolls and information, most of them Arabic texts that were translated from Greek texts. And so Aristotle, Plato, Socrates did not come from monks copying things. It came from the Islamic tradition of not only keeping this knowledge, but actually utilizing it to build grand cities. That, in fact, what happened was when the Pope got tired of all these sort of interesting mercenaries fighting each other and said, get out of here, let's call it a crusade, go free Spain. They walked into Toledo, by the way, and what happened is they discovered these libraries. And what they began doing was they began sending scholars to translate these original Greek texts and mathematics and treatises on astronomy and all this information. And that information began filtering back into Europe, at which point what happened was they began to discover law, they began to discover medicine, they began to discover physics. And these students, these basically aristocratic children in Italy, wanted to get to know this stuff so much that they began hiring tutors that could read and translate the text for them. And what they began doing was then centralizing common housing and pooling their monies to hire tutors, which they eventually called faculty and professors. And some of the original universities that began in the middle of Medici Italy were actually the result of the knowledge that was pouring out of the libraries of Spain, not out of the scripted books. And in fact, that's where the modern university comes from, is this tradition. In fact, not until the turn of the century did we even move from the model of having the students pay the faculty to having the faculty paid separately. And in fact, if you then take this further into the public library, the first public library in Philadelphia was not Franklin's. That was a for fee library. You had to pay to get into that library. The first one, which is the Free Library of Philadelphia, was actually created by the name of Dr. Pepper, I swear to God, who was a professor at University of Pennsylvania and had a rich uncle who donated a lot of money to create the Free Library, but it was created as a social civic service to educate and prepare the citizens of Philadelphia. It had no fee. It had all was about access. Now, the difference between these two stories is that it, moving from collection to scholarship, not looking at the Library of Alexandria as a bunch of stuff that we lost, but as a place of innovation. Looking at from the scriptorium, which was disseminating knowledge, to action, which is these Islamic libraries in Moorish Spain that looked at how do we change the world, and moving from the idea of sharing to a social good. This was about sharing materials. This was about making Philadelphia better. The real big difference is we're talking about knowledge as thing versus knowledge as action. A book is not knowledge. A CD is not knowledge. These are not knowledge. They're containers. They're encoding. They come from a knowledge process. They can spark a knowledge process. But they're not knowledge. It's you know, like, for example, I have a 5-year-old who's in kindergarten. I love him dearly. This is how not to teach him how to read. Walk into the library, leave him in stacks, hope he's fine for 2 years. Right? You can't just sort of say, ah, by osmosis, I will learn. Right? He needs instruction. He needs curriculum. He needs guidance. He needs ideas of how to do it. He needs education. He needs an action, an activity, not just the thing. The thing is important. This is not the burn your books conversation, I promise. But it's why it's important that we need to understand. This is a picture from the Gutenberg Bible. And the interesting thing about the Gutenberg Bible is that some people, when they look at this thing, they see it as the origin of printing. The reason this thing is important is because that represents Gutenberg really sparked this publishing revolution. Some people look at this as a thing to be preserved. Oh, this is important, this is precious. We've got to worry about the humidity, the acidity. We've got to worry about its containment. We've got to worry about security. Some people look at this thing as religious truth. This is the word of God. Literally otherwise. These perspectives are all about a thing, but they're all radically different. They may have the same artifact in common, but how they understand that artifact, what that artifact means, what that artifact allows them to do, and how it alters their action is radically different. And I would argue that the role of libraries is out here in the context, not in here in the thing. Now, to a degree, we know this, right? Not a lot of you spend time buying books because you can resell them in 30 years at a profit, right? Not a lot of you get the donations and say, boy, which one can we sell first? Right? Normally it's which ones can we recycle first. And thank you for that National Geographic collection. I'm sure it will come in handy. But, right? My favorite story about how people perceive libraries as things and how this makes it absurd was that Onondaga County, where I come from, has a book recycling day. So everyone's supposed to bring their books and recycle them. And oh, my God. the bibliofundamentalists come out in droves and say, my God, we're burning books. No, we're shredding them and pulping them. It's very different. And so they sit there, and so this group is sitting there going, no. And the librarians, to be polite, and you know why in a second, say, we just don't have the people to process all the books. It's good to recycle. And really, the librarians go, we don't want that crap. But, you know, you can't say that loud. And so what happens is this group gets up and says, I have a Boy Scout troop. I'll come help you sort it through. Now, what the library didn't want to say, but then was forced to say, is, by the way, people recycle a lot of other things besides books, like old Hustler magazines, and, you know, really obscene materials get recycled on these days, and not stuff you want kids working your way through. Right? Come on, we'll give them an education. All right. My point with all of this is that the user defines the context of something, not the object, and not you. This is also something that's very important, is that as librarians, I get up there and I say, as librarians, we trained you not to know good information from bad information. You have no special superhuman powers to say, that is a good website, that is a bad website. You can't do it. Anyone, I can pull someone off the street, they can do just as good a job as you. No, Dave, that's not true. Yes, it is. Or, oh, that's what you're teaching them. Syracuse. What we taught you to do, we hope, is to know good and bad information for a given question, for a given situation, for a given need. Right? So my old example, which is getting really old, is a reporter walks into the reference desk and asks for good websites that show how hate groups are using the web to recruit new members. So they send them to the Ku Klux Klan website. Eighth grader comes in looking for after-school programs. Hopefully not the same site that you pointed to, right? Is it a different site? No. Is it a different context? Radically. And that's when librarians shine. Librarians have the ability to negotiate a question, to understand what the question is, to understand the purpose of it, and then find the good, best resource for it. That's where we train. That's where you guys excel above almost everyone else in the universe. Right? Not good, bad. Good, bad for a reason, for a purpose, for a question. I once, Barbara Kwasnik, who on the faculty with me, once described cataloging resources as doing a before-the-fact reference interview. It's a discussion about how are people going to look or find this thing. How are they going to understand this thing? That's how we catalog it. Right? So my point of this is a false assumption. And if we continue on the track of being librarians about these things, we will ultimately run into weird places, and I will probably tell you they're not going to be great places. They're particularly not great places when you realize that these things are going away. And you go, hey, books will never go away. Right, books will never go away. But certainly the way we use books have gone away. We don't encapsulate really important stuff for today in books anymore. If you're a physicist and you're publishing an article, by the time it hits paper, it's an archive. It happened online, literally. And you're in a business setting. It happens through email. It happens through these. We've seen, for example, if you're my academic folks, shout out to the academics, that interlibrary loan, if you look at your statistics, the notion of a journal has been destroyed by full-text databases. People look for articles. They don't look for journal titles. Right? They might care about journal titles. If they're going up for tenure, they care a lot about impact factors. But when they're looking for the information, they want the article. So these containers-like things are temporary. And by the way, you say, well, Dave, of course, books are out. But the same goes for CDs, DVDs, the same thing goes for web pages. These things are artifacts. They're important. They're useful. But they're secondary to the main purpose, which is the knowledge that's going on. What's most important in this entire process is Bob here. This is Bob. All right? So let's talk a little bit about Bob. Bob's our user. All right? And what we're going to do with Bob is we're going to find out how Bob thinks. Because this is important. If this is our primary concern, which is how people learn and how people understand. If libraries are in the knowledge business, that means we're not in the thing business. It means we're in the knowledge business, and that sits up here. And that means the people sit at the center of what we do. Right? So what we need to do is we need to understand how our user, how our patron, how our member, how our whatever thinks about the world, because that's going to dictate what we do and how we do it. Not which container can we get our hands on or what the nature of the container is. By the way, I've taken the mantle of power. I apologize. I just realized that. So I want to just walk through a little bit because if we understand a little bit about how people think, it changes how we do things.
Right? So what we're going to start with is Bob. And Bob has a question as represented by said circle. This is a gap in his knowledge. If you want to be academic about all this stuff, you can go back to 1968 Bob Taylor, who I call this guy Bob after, who wrote about question negotiation. And he talks about the fact is you sort of wake up one day and don't know what's going on. And you need to ask a question about it. And if you're a reference librarian, you've fought with this all the time. How do you get someone to ask you about something they don't know about? Right? Google does a really great job. What it does is I'll take a keyword and give you back a bunch of results and hope for the best. And they'll be popular. Right? That's not what we do, right? We try and actually dig out, and it's like therapy sometimes. Well, I'm sorry you don't know how to do this, right? And I once heard Sarah Weissman once talked about the reference interview as putting a patron on the rack until they tell you the truth. So I walk up to the reference desk and I'm like, I would like books on nutrition. And you sit there and go, no, you don't. You don't say that, but you think it. And then you go, well, what kinds of books on nutrition? You go, well, maybe books about how I can be better nutrition or less nutrition or, okay, I'm fat and I need a diet book, right? That's what we get. But we're not allowed to actually ask them why they need to know it. Anyway, so we got this gap. Now, where the gap came from? Well, the gap comes from two places. First, it comes from what they already know. In other words, they can sort of understand the bounds of what they don't know by what they know. The other thing it comes from is either an internal source or an external source. So intrinsic motivation means I want to know. Right? We in libraries do brilliantly with intrinsically motivated individuals. These are the stories we love to tell. These are the stories of the fifth grader who comes in and glows as they tell you the beauty of the book. This is the person who comes in desperately wants to find the medical information that's because they're home care provider, and this is the thing we have. We're great with intrinsic motivation. But we also have to realize that a lot of folks we get are extrinsically motivated. Now, my school librarians, shout out to my school librarians, we deal with these a lot, right? I need a paper. Why? Because I have to cite a damn paper. Right? Which one? I don't care. Right? These are extrinsically motivated individuals. Now, what's interesting is if we ignore the fact that they're internally or extrinsically motivated, we do them a disservice. Right? For example, I love this idea that somehow the reference interview is the most teachable moment. That someone comes to you wide open and vulnerable with a question. And you can bring them through to the other side. Well, if their teacher told them to get the article and they don't care which one, you're not teaching them a damn thing. I mean, it's really. You have to be able to determine, is this an intrinsically or extrinsically? I mean, let's face it. How many of my academic librarians, you know the paper that's due on the 13th of October? Right? And you have the answer. Oh, you have the answer. You don't give out the answer, but you have it, right? You just sort of make them twist a little bit because that's information literacy. But then once you've had your fun with them, it's like, hey, here's what you needed all along, right? That's not a teachable moment, right? But we need to understand why and how and move it, because if we understand, for example, what motivates the user intrinsically, what motivates them extrinsically, and we can bridge the gap. That's when brilliance occurs. So, two examples of this. Eli Nyberger runs a gaming competition at the Ann Arbor District Library. And he started running games where they come and they play with the Wii and they play with all these different games and systems. And he said the teenage boys flock to it. This is why he gets a lot of attention, because teenage boys in a public library is, right next to a Republican in Massachusetts. But anyway, they come in and they say, well, wait, Mitt Romney came from here. Oh, God. Well, there goes that analogy. All right. Exceptions approve the rule? What? All right. So the teenage boys came in, and what happened was it used to be that when he looked at the motivation. And it used to be when teenage boys would come to the library, they were drag-kicking and screaming, don't let anyone see me, because the library was seen as a net detractor of social capital. That to be seen there was actually bad for your image. And what happened when they started offering gaming systems is not only did they offer these gaming programs, but they began putting up the results online of who was best in the game. And now what happens is teenage boys started dragging their friends to the website and online in the competition because it showed them how good they were at something they really cared about, gaming. And so what happened is the library became moved from a net detractor of social capital to a net asset of social capital. And understanding that motivation, it wasn't because kids just wanted to play games. It was also, frankly, that this population in particular wanted to be visible in showing their prowess in doing the games. And so without the tournament nature of the gaming program, it might not have been as well attended. That's the idea of understanding these different motivations. Now, so we have Bob here. He's got a question. And what he's going to do is explore the domain of this question over time. Okay? And through that, he's going to change how he knows about something. So now what does Bob do? Now, this comes from something called conversation theory. Conversation theory, a fellow by the name of Gordon Pask in the 60s set out to teach machines to think. And what he did to start with is he figured he modeled it on how people think. And so he set out to understand how people learn. And what he says, knowing. And what he found out is that people learn through conversation. That people build their knowledge through conversation. And that therefore, what this person is seeking to engage this domain, what he begins to do is engage in a series of conversations. Now, this isn't because I ran out of icons. This is because those conversations can be one-on-one, one-to-group, group-to-group, organization-to-organization, society-to-society, and it can go the other way and be within the same individual. And if you just said to yourself, what does he mean by that? Who were you talking to? Metacognition and critical thinking means we talk to ourselves all the time and not out loud in front of reference desks when we do it most of the time. But this idea that we engage in conversation, an internal dialogue. So when you talk about someone learning from a book, and you say, Dave, if knowledge is created through conversation and they're reading a book, where's the conversation? They're having the conversation, not with the book, with themselves that the book is prompting. Do I understand this? How does this relate to what I already know? Is that true? Do I believe it? Don't I believe it? What's going on? That idea of conversations can happen within an individual, can happen at any level. So what he's doing through this conversation is a conversation consists of four things. A conversant, the people engaged in it, as we said, groups, external organizations, themselves. Language that's exchanged back and forth. And that language can either be very directional and basic, like if you get someone who asks, this is the person who asks a question they know nothing about. You know this language, it's crude and it's clunky and it's very directional. Do you have books in? Right? Do you have books about? Where are they? What do I do next? That's sort of what we call L0 language. Or it can be very sophisticated. So when I say the word catalog in this crew, no one sits there and goes, JCPenney's is awesome. Right? So we have a very different understanding. We're having different language usage here. Right? So language is going on. And what they're doing through this language is a negotiation. They're coming to a series of agreements. Right? And then they remember them. So what do I mean by agreement? So as he's going through this conversation, using language, he comes to a series of agreements. What is that? Well, an agreement is really an abstract thing. It's an understanding in their mind. Right? So an agreement could be things like, you know, Massachusetts good. Something like 2 plus 2 equals 4 is an agreement. Or we can then scaffold them together and we get things like 4x equals 2, x therefore equals 0.5. Quick algebra. It's always fun. Right? The idea is that we come up with these agreements. Now, these agreements then scaffold and relate to each other. Agreements don't happen out of their own. Quick test about what that means. Ready? I'm going to give you a word. You think about what it means. Ready? Formula. How, by show of hands, how many people thought chemical combination? How many people thought mathematical expression? How many people thought, would you give a baby to keep it from starving today? New grandmas, new aunts. Now, you laugh, but it makes sense, right? It was slightly unexpected by the first two examples, but it makes sense. And the reason is because you've come to encounter that term and give meaning to it in multiple ways. You've dealt with it as a parent. You've dealt with it as chemistry class. You've dealt with it in math class or whatever it is. So they make sense. All right, next one. Light. Right? Illumination? Not heavy? Set a fire. I always like to ask that question early to see where my pyromaniacs are. Right? One last one. OMG. What does OMG mean? Right. Oh my God! But it's not Omnicom Media Group, and it's not, you know, Omnipotent Man Go. Because when we encounter that phrase, we encounter very limited domains. We have a very strong relationship between a technology called texting and this phrase. We encounter light all the time. We encounter formula a lot more than we do, though. So our brain stores concepts And they can be very sophisticated concepts like library. We know from OCLC studies that people out in the civilians out there say books. Right? Now, we probably may not. I would argue that our processes show that we often do, even though we may not say it. But that's the idea of an agreement. Now, that agreement may point to an artifact, a book, a web page, where we learned it, what we were talking about, what we agreed on it. Or, and it also will include some memory of the conversant, who we talked about, whether it was ourselves or other. Now, we know that over time, that artifact and that conversant will actually disappear and the agreement will stay. We see this all the time in the notion of credibility. That when you say something over and over again, it becomes true. Remember this famous statement? And, you know, lots of rife political examples here. But the idea is that we will make an agreement and oftentimes forget how we made the agreement, even though that agreement is now in our mind is where it happens. Right? Now, this presents a new sort of logic for us. And the logic goes, instead of books lead to catalogs, lead to standards, first of all, the user is in control. That if this is how we learn, the user must be in control of that process because they're a conversant. You cannot passively learn something. I really wish you could, or my high school education would have gone much better. You must be awake, you must think about it, you must fight with it, you must integrate it into your neural net until you understand it. Right? So the user becomes in control of that process. It's like you can't bring a horse to water. You can bring a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. The truth is you can make it drink, but then it drinks too much and dies because you held its head under the water. You know, the user's in that control of that process. It's all about learning. It's all about learning. And if it's all about learning, learning is more than simply access. You can't simply get someone to a conversation and expect them to understand what's going on. You cannot expect for someone to gain knowledge simply because they have access to something. And if you look at what we do a lot in libraries is access. I've now broken the chain of authority.
I'll buy you a new one.
The idea that it's all about learning, right? So even the facilitation of learning requires more than just access. So imagine someone comes in, well, even better. Have you ever been on a committee and you clearly walked into a committee that has existed before God? Right? And a couple things happen. First of all, they speak a different language and so you don't know what it is. The second thing is every committee will have the historian. And the historian is the person who's there to make you feel silly. Right? So you will say something like, you'll be on the web committee, and you'll say, we need to blog. And the historian will say something like, well, what you need to remember, and it always starts with our need to remember, what you need to remember is in 1932, we tried blogging, and it didn't work. And you, being the person you are, say, what do you mean in 1932? Well, we did it by correspondence. We wrote letters down and sent them around. People commenting. Right? So it involves getting to the conversation. It involves then knowing the history of that conversation, knowing the language that's being used, knowing the players, knowing about what's going on. It involves feeling like you're in a safe environment. So that person's job sometimes is to make you not feel so safe. If you've been in those meetings where you don't feel you can talk, that's because you don't feel safe. Now imagine your patrons do the same thing. When they walk into your library, do they feel safe? Now safety can mean physical safety in our public libraries where you're like kids, but also intellectual safety. If I use this and I search and I look at, are my records going to be available to the FBI? Right? All these are about safety. So you must provide an environment of safety. And the next thing we need to provide is a sense of motivation, which is why. To either recognize or at least enable the motivation that brought them to there. Recognize why they did it. So, for example, libraries have two identities in them, librarian and not librarian. It's not a very sophisticated schema, I realize. Right? Librarians are the people who control the keys to the system. Not librarians don't. So when the governor decides to come visit a library, and he goes and he looks at the record of his latest book. I assume he has the latest book. You look at it and he says, oh, you got this wrong. He can't actually change the thing, right? A librarian has to come in that has access to the system, right? He's not a librarian. So this notion of we get out of the gatekeeper business. Remember we used to be in the gatekeeper business and we congratulate ourselves that we got out of it? Ha! You tell me you're not gatekeeping your catalog. user annotations. Oh my God, it'll ruin our records.
Well, you know, get over it. Right, so it's all about
right.
That learning itself is a collaborative conversation. Now, this is really important. That learning means that they need to engage in conversation. It's why the best thing I can say about our libraries that have changed over the past 10 years is we have moved from the quiet building with the noisy room to the noisy building with the quiet room. Brilliant. Absolutely. It's what we need to do. And that collaboration is not necessarily between you and the patron. It may be between them and their buddy. And so what we need to talk about is how do we facilitate that conversation? Maybe it's physical space. Maybe it's the idea that, oh, here's a group, and they love manga.
Thank you, manga. Manga. Little big-eyed, cute Japanese girls running around with monsters after them.
And you say, this is a good conversation. They're learning. They care about it. They're engaged. Here's your shelf. Here's your shelf. You maintain it. Oh, that. The extension cost alone would drive us. No, they don't want a catalog. Oh, but the security, someone might take it. That's their choice. If you literally said, this is your shelf in a physical space, you're in charge, you control it. But what you're saying is, this is a place you have a conversation and you have ownership of. But it's the same thing with public libraries. If you want to talk about increasing teams' use of your public library, how many teams do you have on your board? Why should they use you if you don't trust them? Right? This idea of how do you get ownership with the community, not how do you serve that community, but how do you really literally become the community? That the library serves as facilitators of these conversations, and that true facilitation with that community means shared ownership. Right? And that we need to invest in creation tools over collections of artifacts. So, for example, we talked to a bunch of musicians in Philadelphia. We said, what do you want out of the library? And they said, we want 2 grand pianos on a stage. I said, no, you want more music? What kind? No, we want 2 grand pianos on a stage. And we said, sir, why? And the answer was, look, I write classical music, but there's no one who can make a living as a composer these days in classical music. The publishing industry is gone. There are like three. Right? So I don't have a venue for outlet. And when I look at how I learn about music and how I engage in my community to advance music, it's by playing music. And so when I come to the library, I may be looking for other people's music, but more often than not, I want to engage in this conversation, which means I need a place to play. I need a place to come in and have play nights. I need to put on the concert. You can record them and put it in your collection. And it turned into something very interesting, which was not only is this a place where they could produce, musicians learn about music by playing music. That not only could they produce, but it became this interesting observation that many times our libraries turn our back to the user as we show them the way. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is there is this wonderful Dewey-esque concept of a public library, which is a co-equal educational institution in the public world. So meaning public schools, public libraries, same thing. Right? Now, when he said it, what he meant was we will bring people into the library and we will educate them. We will teach them literacy, which meant we will teach them the right literacy. We will teach them the good stuff. All right, and that whole little song and dance I did about librarians picking good stuff and bad stuff, Dewey would stand up and go, damn straight. Right? And if it's Edwardian white male stuff, I'm ready. Slightly anti-Semitic. Not slightly, in many cases. Anyway, the idea here is that we turn to the back and say, we are bringing the world to our patrons. Well, what if we turned around and said, you know what? Our patrons are pretty cool. They're doing lots of new discovery and knowledge. They're learning things. When you look at the Philadelphia music scene, what if we capture that in our libraries? And so the rest of the world comes to the Philadelphia library to learn about Philadelphia's music scene. Not the Philadelphians coming to the library to learn about the rest of the world. They can do that. That's an important thing. But we shouldn't do it by turning our back to those patrons. We need to worry about them creating information. This isn't a place of consumption. We're not the marketplace of ideas. Right? We're not the mall of ideas. Right? We're an idea mall. Come in, shop, take what you want, leave. We really are more the marketplace, the commons, where people come in and deposit knowledge as well as take knowledge and understand. Now, I could go a couple of different ways with this. It happens in the digital world. I could spend some time talking about how this concept now gets grounded into real systems and real software and talk about how this turns into real services and get down in the mud. And I've done that. And in fact, I could do that now, but I refuse. Go look at this stuff. You can get my slides online. This gets really specific. Because that Bob Dylan thing keeps ringing in my head,
which is the times they are changing. And I really do believe that we live in historic times. I believe that we live in times of great transition where we need to think really big and really big thoughts. And I think all too often librarians, me included, become so obsessed with the specific and with process and with how it gets implemented that sometimes we don't take the time to think about the grand mission that we are on. And I'd like to spend a little bit of time on that grand mission.
Now, I talked a little bit about the pressure for participation. That if people are engaging in learning and conversation, that means that they need to be active constructors of their knowledge, and that means that they want tools that facilitate those knowledge. So they want to show up at our library and be able to create and catalog and understand and take away, not just get fed to. But I will tell you that there's another side to that, which is there is an equal pressure for participation in the community upon us. That we need to have conversations. If we're about conversations and learning, then we are about change. We're about change organizations. What libraries are is to change the world that we are in for the better. Right? We're not in the documenting business. Right? I love the idea, we need more data. Right? Sometimes it rings to me like taking passenger customer satisfaction surveys on the Titanic as it's sinking. And how did you find the meals? We're sinking. And really, and the okay, we're sinking. And how was the band playing as you were going? Yeah, we're in lifeboats. Well, now that we have the data, we'll come up with an action plan. Right? We need to think about the fact that we are in the process of creating that future and inventing that future, and that means that we need to be engaged in conversation. Now, the other thing I said is that conversation is a two-way street. We engage people in conversation, we talk, but that means we also shape. Facilitation is not invisible or unbiased. To facilitate is to shape. That this idea that somehow we should take every document we have about we provide unbiased service and we should strike out the word unbiased. Now, that is the sacred calf for the day, but here is why I say that. It is impossible to be unbiased. If someone asks you a question at a reference desk and you start doing this or you start reaching for a book, you have shown a bias. When you decide how something is classified when it goes into your catalog, you have shown a bias. Not only the classification scheme has a bias, but your selection within the classification scheme demonstrates a bias. When you talk about what does and does not circulate, you have demonstrated a bias. You demonstrate a bias in your collection development policies. Biases are how human beings exist. We build a set of frameworks and assumptions that as we navigate in the world, we assume are going to happen. When you wake up in the morning and you go to work, you don't assume that you won't make it to work. You assume the car will start. You assume you'll make it safely and won't get into an accident. Now, sometimes things happen. But we build this all the time. I think we should replace the word unbiased with intellectually honest. Intellectually honest means we are willing to declare our biases. We are willing to set aside our biases in service of the patron's knowledge. But we must be intellectually honest in how we do it. Right? So, back to Bob. The mission of the library then becomes not more stuff, does not become providing access to. The mission of the library is to facilitate the knowledge creation of its community through conversation. That what we are really about doing is improving the communities that we serve. And we don't do that by collecting the refuge that comes off the community. We don't do that by going and grabbing stuff the community doesn't have and warehousing it. We do it through engagement. We do it through a regular basis of listening and being part of. If you're a public library, you're serving a community, are you actually the information arm of that community town government? Do you have the archives of the meetings and the messages? Do you, when the mayor has a question, are you the research service that he reaches out to? Are you the place where someone has a collection of materials that they know they can place it and still control it and own it? Because here's the deal. Change the community for the better. That's what we really want to do. That's the story we love to tell. That's the story you told. We change the world for a better. But that means we change it
And we can only change it if we engage it and we have conversations about it.
Then you go, Dave, we've done it. We've succeeded. Okay. So 2 days ago, we came out with a press release about a project we're working on called Reference Extract. And what's interesting is the idea is that we're going to take reference librarians and their answers and we're going to turn it into a search engine. And what's amazing is the minute we put it out, all the headlines looked like this one from the Huffington Post.
I was also cited in the New York Times. My mom got a great phone call that day. It said, librarians to attempt to outsmart Google. This was not our line. People read into this and said, oh, that's what they're trying to do.
That's what they want us to do.
Anyway, now, in response to this comment, or in response to this article, someone put a comment, and I love this comment because it ticks me off. Now, that is an interesting idea. Quality instead of quantity. Of course, we have to ask ourselves, what took librarians 10 years to realize that? I do note that being a librarian is kind of a slow profession, but still, it's not like we couldn't have collected high-quality links a long time ago. Everyone here who has collected a high-quality link in the past 10 years, please raise your hand. This is the teachable moment, right? This is the game that we need to engage. When people stand up who happen to be at, I don't know, Harvard, and they stand up and say things like, I think that, you know, books are going to become electronic and that's going to do away with our need for libraries, we need to be up there and say, no, excuse me. Uh-uh. First of all, if books go away, that's just fine by us. We were here in the clay tablet and scroll business before your stinking books. And we were always in the knowledge and information business before that. This idea that we need, this is a conversation we need to engage in. This is the conversation where we don't just engage by being nice and say, oh, sorry, excuse me. Well, libraries do that. We need to shout them, excuse me! Libraries are different, wake up! Right? This is the world that we need to talk about. Right? Libraries must be active, radical change agents. We can no longer hide behind our collections. We can no longer pretend that our collections somehow speak for us. I talked to a collection development person at a large, prestigious academic library, and I said, I got an idea. Let's find out the kinds of things our reference librarians are citing and use that part of collection development. In which she looked at me and said, well, we build collections for the next 100 years, the next generations. And I wanted to look at them and say, you know what they're going to be like in 100 years? Cool! Do we get jetpacks? I want jetpacks. This idea that somehow we can predict the future. I think we can shape it and we can create it, but we need to understand that our collections are not us. I firmly believe that if you have a room full of materials, it is not a library. If you have an empty room with a librarian in it, it's a library. That's the difference. When people looked at the Library of Alexandria and said, oh, they burned it down and destroyed the library, the question is, did the librarians escape? Because we're still okay. Right? That's the difference. That we need to be thinking of these change agents, and we can't let our collections tell the budget. I'm just guessing a testimony in front of legislatures, when you stand up and talk about 9 million volumes, how they wax eloquent about that, and how many times you have to tell a story about Sally, and how Sally got A's on her paper because she had that library in front of her. That's the story that's compelling. Every librarian has the story. You all have the story. You know the story. It's the story that you take out from the back of your head when, after a long day of changing toner cartridges and mindless committee meetings, you ask yourself, why the hell are you doing this job? You take out the story. That story about when the fifth grader came in and you zest them up with the perfect book and it led them to being a great reader. That story about how a congressman came in and asked you a question and it led to better legislation. That story about a woman who came in looking for social services and got out of a bad marriage. That story that can be as profound as shaping someone's life and as simple as finding them a great read but making a natural human connection. And I will guarantee you that that story never starts with, and I cataloged this great book. And the band got there on time. Those are great. Those are important. But that's not the story. The story, I will guarantee you that 99.9% of the stories that we share them will start with a conversation. We'll start with a human connection. We'll start with understanding what people need. Right? We can no longer serve from the side. We can no longer stand back and say, that is where we must go. I hope you're headed in that direction too. Or as the famous French philosopher said, go find out where that mob is going so I may get in front of them and lead them. Right? This idea that somehow we don't have a voice in this. That we must be active and participate in the improvement of our community and larger society. That we cannot be, for example, silent on matters of ignorance. What do I mean? Let me give you some examples of ignorance. Luckily, they're not my own. Out of 34 countries in the United States, out of 34 countries, the United States ranks near the bottom of acceptance of evolution. Only Turkey ranks lower than us. One adult in every American in five believes that the sun revolves around the earth. Here's one on science. 78% happen to know the center of the earth is very hot. 85% knew that the oxygen we breathe comes from plants. 44% understood that electrons were smaller than atoms. 79% knew that the continent of which we live have been moving to their locations for millions of years. 48% of the earliest human beings lived at the same time as dinosaurs, because the Flintstones taught us all our history. 75%, 47% could answer. So 53% of adults in America could not answer the question, how long does it take for the Earth to go around the sun? One day, one month, or one year? I would tell you that this is our mission. That our mission is the noblest and best of the education of our communities. That when people walk around, and you know, I'm going to go ahead and go politic on you here. In this last election, when people could walk out of and be videotaped in rallies talking about their president-elect was a Muslim terrorist. Not, I don't like him, not Bill O'Reilly is an idiot, but literally, I think he's a Muslim terrorist and he's about to be elected. That's a failure of our libraries. Now, people may not like to think that way because they're idiots around the world, and how can we be held accountable for idiots? But we live in communities and we are responsible for those communities. And so we need to worry about education statistics and rising them. Even if they're standardized tests, we should be able to demonstrate how we were part of the standardized test. When you look at things like, and by the way, equal opportunity, if you don't want to play the evolution game, about 1 in 6 parents don't know that the document that declared the American colonies free from the British rule, Declaration of Independence, in case you're wondering. Only 45.9% of those surveyed knew that the sentence, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal, is from the Declaration of Independence. U.S. Department of Education reports that nearly 6 out of 10 high school seniors are basically historically illiterate. They fail to know even which century the Civil War was fought in or why it was fought. An official at Mount Vernon reports that many visitors think Washington fought in the Civil War. This is a problem. And one of those biases that I think we should have, the bias should be, that's not okay. Right? Now, I give this thing about conversation, facilitating conversation. The first question I always get is, well, what happens if people are talking about it and they come up with the wrong answer? I said, one, that's going to happen. And two, should you step in and fix it? Well, it's the wrong answer. What are you going to do about it? Well, we don't want to bias the conversation. Yes, you do. You want to fix it. That's okay. That's good. This libraries are perfectly situated to take on these missions. First of all, we function as authorities, not authoritarians. When people look at libraries, they look at them as authorities, not as authoritarians. What's the difference? An authoritarian tells you what's right or wrong. An authority is one you believe gives you the right or wrong information. We've earned the respect of our constituents. We need to continuously earn that. But if we start getting around this idea of we only put good stuff in our library, we switch from this directly to this. Or sorry, back to that. We're honest brokers and facilitators. We're tool builders. I'm tired of hearing about librarians think that tools just mean technology, and that if it is technology, they somehow abdicate it to some other group. This idea that, you know, oh my God, technology's hard. Trust me if I told you, if you went into a smackdown with a technologist on three-letter acronyms, you'd win. Find your favorite Java programmer and explain a MARC record to them. They will leave weeping. Right? We are a technical profession. we were talking, once again, I keep harping on document delivery because Greg didn't want us to, but I don't care. You can become UPS. Congratulations. That's not easy. Right? I mean, it's not like you said, hey, let's do document delivery. I got a van. Let's go. Right? You have barcodes, for God's sake. You have barcodes. Right?
Sorry. I get a little emotional about barcodes.
Me too. We provide the connective tissue to our organization. This is what's amazing. So, academic thing. If you've been in an academic library, you've had a provost come up and talk to you about interdisciplinary at one point. The future of academia is interdisciplinary and cross-disciplinary study. And everyone goes, oh, God. Right? You librarians should love the fact that, that academics and faculty are silos, because you fit right between them all. That what happens is Dave's the information guy, and this is the biologist guy, and this is the anthropology gal, and you have to know they're all using the same resources or talking about the same question. You are an amazing matchmaker. You provide this connective tissue. In public communities, you know that if someone over here is dealing with an issue of youth violence, and over here they're dealing with youth violence, you can bring them together. Libraries are one of the few trusted agencies in societies and our communities that span the whole dimension of civic life. We don't trust City Hall all the time. Our schools only deal with our kids. Our civil services only deal with our less fortunate. Libraries deal with them all. And what's amazing is that public libraries deal with not only the poor people, of which we serve as a safety net, we deal with the Nobel literates as well. Laureates. We bring this whole span together. People always have this idea that the public library is this interesting covenant between those who have and those who have not. That one approach is that our public library, Philadelphia Free Library, oh, what happens is we want rich people to give us money and resources so we can serve the poor people. We looked at the actual statistics of the use of the online website. 80% were college educated. Huge number of them had over six-figure salaries. We are serving that population. We may not be serving them in our physical location, but they are of the same constituents. We bridge that gap. That is one, an amazing opportunity and an awesome responsibility. That we can talk about as a society, as a culture, if you want to have an impact, don't go to the schools. We've got to be careful here because we have school librarians. But the truth is, if you want to impact the education, libraries are actually the wedge in which you can do that much more effectively. We provide these connective tissues. Imagine, if you will, a distributed network of 123,291 libraries having conversations. This is the number of libraries in the United States. It includes special libraries, school libraries, which is the bulk of it, public libraries, academic libraries, federal libraries. Imagine we're having these conversations. Not we're collecting a bunch of stuff. OCLC's dream was, imagine each one of these, if they buy a book, they share the metadata. Right? Now, that had a pretty amazing and radical effect on our profession. But think about how small that is in comparison to the impact we could have about knowledge gathering and conversations and communities. Imagine that if we network these conversations together so that someone who sits at the Capitol could understand what's happening in North Andover and Ashland and Boston and Salem and whatever. Imagine if they could reach down and understand this is the impact that happened and how it rippled out from that community. Imagine millions of conversations sharing, relating, understanding, this sort of amazing idea of taking questions. You want to talk about crowdsourcing? Imagine taking the world's worst problems and distributing it out through every library and saying, you know, we're going to devote an hour to this. 123,291 hours on a given topic that we could provide. Imagine that level of sharing. Imagine creating an infrastructure to the marketplace of ideas. We like to think that we're in the education, innovation, marketplace of ideas. The problem is right now it's a messy, unregulated, disjointed place. What if we could step in and say, you know what? Have the ideas. We're not going to get in the way, but what we're going to be there is to capture the good ones and foster them and share them. We have a financial system that melted down. And it melted down because we did not have an effective infrastructure for how we regulate the movement of capital. We have no infrastructure to regulate and capture the movement of ideas across borders, across people, across disciplines. Imagine if we could be there as honest brokers to make sure that it doesn't get censored and doesn't get cut down, but it gets expanded and facilitated. Imagine the power we have there. But we must be prepared. We must be radical change agents and see that level of impact.
that we don't just want to impact what's happening in our communities. We want to be part of a global network that impacts society at large. We need to fix our innovation cycle. Repeat after me. New hires are not the solution. Right? I prepare the new hires, keep hiring them. But if we constantly say, you know, Jane the young librarian is the one that will deal with that when it's anything new, what we, you know, Jane, by the way, could be 98 and on a ventilator, but still the young librarian. But because they somehow just got newly branded with their MLS, they somehow understand innovation better. So what we do is take the most important thing we do, the future of innovation, hand it to the person with the least experience, the least political capital, the least understanding of the organization, and say, go! No! This is nuts. We need to fix our education system. The idea that somehow 2.5 years at the beginning of your career prepares you to be a radical change agent for the rest of your life is nuts. We need undergraduate degrees, master's degree, PhD, a coherent set of continuing education, so if you take it in this organization, if you take it at ALA, it counts. The idea that teachers are not allowed to be teachers unless they go back and continue to learn how to be good teachers. But librarians can be that way for the rest of your life. Physical therapists have to continuously learn new techniques, but librarians that deal only with the important things like the knowledge of society will give a pass. This is the problem. Ultimately, we must, I'm going to skip this one, act now and accept the obligation of leadership. We must innovate from our core principles, and those core principles are not about books and materials and processes. They're about knowledge and conversations and learning. We must question tradition. The two most important questions you must ask every day in your library is why and why not? Why are we doing this and why aren't we doing this? Now, there are always good answers. Why are we doing this document delivery service? Because it's going through the roof and people love it. Good answer. Why are we doing this Elastic system? I think if I tie this together, would that be all right? You know? Why and why not? Why aren't we doing the blog? Well, this is my favorite response. By the way, why aren't you doing a blog? Because no one wants to read it. Okay! Do it anyway. I mean, there are a lot of people in this whole Library 2.0 that tell you you need to blog. Neglect to tell you why, but you need to blog. Right? You need to ask them why on a regular basis. But the why not, you got to be really careful for that, because it's almost never asked. Because the idea of, oh, the lawyers won't let us do it. Did you ask the lawyers? Oh, the city would never let us do that. Did you ask the city? Oh, the faculty would never accept it. Did you ask the faculty? Do we have these ongoing, engaged conversations where we are so seamlessly integrated into the communities that we serve that we can ask that by literally turning our heads, not creating a focus group? That's where we need to be, right? We need to hold our visionaries to account. When people like me come and get very loud that we tend to do, that doesn't mean we're right. That means we're loud. Right? You need to look at these people and say, where's your data? Where's your theory? You know, I'm not going to pick on anyone individually, but I've been at too many conferences about, you know, how the internet has totally radically changed the universe and put it on a totally different tilt. Like, wikis and the discovery of the Holy Grail turn out to be the same damn thing. Right? This is nuts. You know what's going to impact libraries a lot more on a day-to-day basis than a wiki? It's called the age gap. The idea that since over 40 years, the average age has increased from 45 to 78. The life expectancy in this country has increased 40 years over the past century. Right? Tell me that's not a bigger impact than wikis. Tell me the idea of baby boomers and what they need and what services they need and what kind of economic equality and contributions they make is not going to impact this. Tell me that these different factors in our community, this is what matters. What is it in your community? You know, are you a community that has an aging population you need to deal with, or are you a new community that doesn't have any history? What is it that your community needs to know? Right? You need to become a mentor on a regular basis. And the definition of a mentor for me is someone who is dedicated to the success of another over themselves. That a good mentor is someone who wants you to do better than they did and actively works towards it. A good mentor is not someone who sits there and just tells them a story of history. Because ultimately, you are the future of libraries. That answer, I have this great theory, and I believe in it, and I'm going to work towards it. But it only comes into you. This idea that the library is somehow some institution put down here by some almighty being 300 years ago and happens to have ivy on it is nuts.
I don't want to hear another librarian say, oh, I wish I could do that, but the library won't let me. You are the library. There's nothing that says that we have to catalog books. There's nothing that says we have to offer reference service. There's nothing that says we have to offer Sunday service. There is nothing written in the stones that tell us that we even have to exist. We are an agreement of a collective. We are an agreement of people, and people can change how they organize and what they do. So that means that when we look at the future, it is not a question of what is done to us. It is not a question of what happens out there. It is all about what we do on a daily basis. Thank you very much.